This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 216, was recorded on April 23rd, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is dedicated to healthcare workers all over the world, the true heroes of the COVID-19 pandemic crisis, and is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. We've got a terrific episode lined up for you this week. We'll start with economist David Rosenberg joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll cover the stock market outlook, bond yields, and inflation versus stagflation outlook, plus a whole lot more. Now, most of you know Dave as the former Merrill Lynch chief economist and the author of the infamous Breakfast with Dave newsletter. But Rosie launched his own research firm this year, parting ways with the private wealth management firm that he was previously associated with. So we'll get the inside scoop on what led Dave to branch out on his own. And of course, I'll hit him up for a free trial of his new product offerings just for Macro Voices listeners. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when we'll take a deep dive into the crude oil market. We'll discuss the May WTI contract dipping all the way down to minus $40 briefly, what it means, and perhaps more importantly, what it doesn't mean, and what we can expect in coming months.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, listeners, we'll have a detailed update on the COVID-19 coronavirus in our post-game segment after the feature interview. Now, Eric, let's just jump right into the S&P 500. We continue to muddle around 2,800 here for almost a week. What do you think? Is this still a bear market rally in your mind?
I still think it's a bear market rally. Top might be in. Maybe we've still got room to go. You know, I've been eyeing the 61.8 Fib retrace, which is 2930. As I've said before, I probably won't trade it, though. And the primary reason is just having watched what happened with the Fed bailing out the junk bond market. As far as I'm concerned, that was both illegal and immoral. They shouldn't have done it. But what's to stop them from bailing out the stock market if it starts to go down? I mean, they're not supposed to do that either, but it didn't stop them on junk bonds. Why would it stop them on stocks? If I was going to play this market, I'd want to play it the safe way, which is with options. Well, the VIX is still kind of expensive, so options are expensive. So to me, it's not really as appealing of a short as it was the last time around.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index. And the Dixie is above 100. The euro is toying with breaking 108 on the downside. Is the dollar breakout still a part of your narrative?
Well, we're consolidating along here. Yes, we're above 100, but we're still below 101, which would be the next test just to get a higher high in this, what I think is going to be an uptrend here. Really, it's 104, which is the key level we need to take out in order to really prove my thesis. But again, my conviction is waning here simply because I think all of the bad stuff going on in the world definitely should be dollar positive, and there is a U.S. dollar shortage. But I mean, just look at what the Fed is doing with all of this intervention and even more perhaps still coming. At some point, it's got to be dollar bearish. So that weakens my bullish conviction a little bit. As I weigh all of the different evidence, I still lean toward an upward outcome for the dollar, but my conviction's not as strong as it was a few months ago.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because right now we're trading at $16.97, but that number does not tell the story at all, does it? What happened this week, Eric?
Well, to tell the full story is going to take more time than we've got in the market wrap. So very briefly, in case anyone missed it, the May WTI contract actually traded at minus $40 at one point briefly on Monday afternoon. Now, to give a quick overview of what that means and doesn't mean, it doesn't really quite mean what it sounds like it means. We didn't really have the price of oil that refiners are paying for their oil, you know, go negative. What we had was a squeeze keys in a contract where some really foolish people got on the wrong side of a trade and they got taken advantage of. It really only affected a few thousand contracts at the end of the day on the second to last day of trading in that contract. The whole story is actually a very interesting story, and it probably has a lot of insight to give us for what may still lie ahead as we navigate this crisis of storage, which is really a bare storage capacity story, is what this is all about. That full story is going to take our entire postgame segment, or most of our postgame segment. So I'm going to leave it there and just finish up with inventory and the market wrap, and we'll get the rest in the postgame segment. Crude oil building 15 million barrels. That was pretty much expected. Cushing, Oklahoma building 4.8 million barrels. Now, Cushing's been building 5 million barrels approximately per week for the last several weeks. I think there's maybe a chance of a surprise coming there. We'll talk about that again in the postgame segment. Gasoline building 1 million barrels. Distillates building 7.9 million barrels. U.S. production ticked down another 100,000 barrels to 12.2 million barrels. Let's save the rest of the crude oil conversation for the postgame segment, Patrick, because it's a doozy.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because it's slowly crawling back to 1750 on the upside. Just feels like every time it sells, someone comes in and scoops it up and brings it right back toward the highs. Do you think we break out in a big way still?
Well, I mentioned my concern last week that there was a ascending wedge pattern that appeared to be resolving to the downside. It did resolve to the downside, resulting in a pullback in price, but that pullback in price was not very deep, only down to about 1660 or so. And now, as you say, we're back up almost to 1750 as we're recording on Thursday afternoon. The thing is, we did break down from that wedge pattern. I'd really like to see a closing print above the previous cycle high, which was 1780 something. I'd like to see that just to sort of finalize my conclusion that the dip is over and we're headed higher from here. The fundamentals couldn't be better. The place where I think you could get a significant pullback in gold would be if the stock market really crashes in a big way. For the moment, that's not happening yet, so I'm not too worried about gold. If we get into a big stock market move, I think it could drag gold lower with it. If that happens, it's a buying opportunity in gold. Long term, couldn't be more bullish on gold.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yields, which are still more or less hovering around spot 6-1 right now. And do you think it doesn't seem to be able to get off of that level? I mean, are we still going lower?
Well, as I've mentioned in the last couple of weeks, Patrick, I really don't know short term where we're going. The way I'm looking at this treasury market is, okay, you know, there's been a really, really strong argument. Lacey Hunt probably has made it better than anyone else, that in this environment of too much debt and a deflationary backdrop and so forth, you know, bond prices just have to go higher. Bond yields have to go lower. You get to the question of, okay, but what happens when you get to the zero bound on the U.S. 10-year treasury? Is that a lower limit, or is it just another number on the way to negative yields? And I think the other really big aspect of this is, okay, I'm convinced and I'm really getting a consensus now. You'll hear this from David Rosenberg in today's interview. Kind of finding that some of the smartest people that I talked to, I had a phone call this week with our good friend Harley Bassman, the convexity maven. You know, I think all the smartest guys see the same thing I do, which is this trend of central bank accommodation is only going to get stronger from here. It eventually has to lead to a shift to secular inflation or stagflation, but that doesn't happen overnight. So the smartest guys in the room all seem to be saying, yeah, that's where we're headed, but it's maybe 2 to 3 years out. So, okay, if the worst thing that can happen to the treasury bond market is inflation, and we think inflation is still at least 2 to 3 years out, does that mean it's time to get worried about rates backing up in the bond market now, or is it just something to keep in mind for 2 to 3 years out? I'd love to ask Dr. Lacey Hunt that question. For now, I'm just trying to ask all of our guests on the show exactly what they think. I don't really have a firm view myself. I'm trying to rely on our guests, and I'm learning along with our listeners, Patrick.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is Rosenberg Research founder David Rosenberg. Now, why did we invite Rosie back to the show this week?
Well, needless to say, he's an iconic guy in the industry. I think the Breakfast with Dave newsletter is probably the longest running daily newsletter in professional finance. And, you know, everybody loves it. You get on the train from Westchester County into New York City and, you know, half the finance guys on the train are reading Breakfast with Dave on their iPads on the way to work. So, he's a super important guy. He's also a guy who's been right a lot about this kind of big macro move that we're seeing. And I wanted to get his perspective now that we're into the throes of this crisis. But also, he recently announced he left the private wealth management firm that he was with and branched out to launch his own firm. So I wanted to find out what that's about, what led him to do that, and what we can expect from him in the future. So we've just been a little bit overdue to get Rosie back on the show, and it was a really great interview. I really enjoyed it. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with David Rosenberg is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is David Rosenberg, founder and president of Rosenberg Research. Now, most of you know Dave as the famous author of the Breakfast with Dave newsletter. He's actually branched out and got some really exciting new products and services that he's starting to explore in his own new firm. So we're going to talk about that at the end of the interview. But David, obviously, we're going to start with, wow, these are amazing times that we're in. I got to tell you, I am just dumbfounded. It seems like maybe a little bit of common sense in the last couple of days has hit the stock market. But until then, it seemed like most people thought, okay, it's all over now. We're past peak infections. It's time for new all-time highs in the stock market. I think it's crazy, but what do you see here? What's the big picture? Is this really ending or is it only just beginning?
Well, look, I think that when you're taking a look at the extreme daily moves that we're seeing in the stock market, it is completely characteristic of a fundamental bear market, not the onset of a new bull market. I mean, we've had just in the past 20 sessions, 18 of those, the Dow moved in either direction by at least 200 points. It's almost like we become numb. Like today, if the Dow moves 400 points up or down, it's completely ho-hum. But these are dramatic daily swings. It's showing a market that is completely confused and I think caught in this tug of war between, I wouldn't say a V-shaped recovery, really caught between knowing that we have a very deep and sharp recession on our hands, but also the Fed coming in and doing what no other Fed has done before. I mean, Jay Powell has made a mockery out of Ben Bernanke, that's for sure, and taking on this role, not just as liquidity backstop, but going into corporate credit, CMBS, municipal bonds, and now into high-yield ETFs. And so the Fed is basically telling investors, we are going to put a pervasive floor under the situation. Now, I'm not saying that the Fed can stop a bear market in its tracks, but what the Fed can do is send a message that it is going to eliminate tail risk. And I think that is what caused, this big, what I'd say, counter-trend rally off the lows was a big part of that was the Fed. And the shock and awe of that is over, and now we're heading back into a period where investors are realizing the deep recession that's staring us in the face and the very low likelihood that we get much of a recovery. So it's really that tug of war deep recession, unknown extent of recovery, and on the other side of that is this ongoing, incredible support that the Fed is trying to provide financial risk assets.
You know, it's amazing, David. The very first thing, the first public statement that I remember Jay Powell making after he took office was to very authoritatively exclaim, look, folks, the Fed is not in the business of bailing out asset markets. So get that through your head. Well, I guess he didn't mean it or something. I think you've perfectly summarized what's going on. And then the big question it leaves me with is, okay, if we were talking about, you know, old normal reality, we've been through recessions before. Financial history teaches us a lot about what to expect. You would expect the stock market to have only just begun a bear market and much lower numbers, new lows still to come. But wait a minute. As you just said, the Fed seems to be in the business of doing what they said they were not going to do, which is bailing out asset markets. They've already done what I think was both immoral and illegal in bailing out the junk bond market through the ETF. Who's to say that stocks are not next? And I do think that's illegal, but it was illegal to bail out HYG. They did that. So what do you make of this? Do we apply the logic that eventually the fundamentals win out? Or is this more of a case of, hey, you know, you wouldn't want to short the stock market no matter how bad you think the recession's going to be, because the Fed's probably going to, you know, put a floor under it?
Well, I guess that, I mean, I'm not going to jump at G. Powell's defense. I think that this was something that started, you know, more than 30 years ago, which is the extent of the powerful relationship now between the financial economy and the real economy, or at least that's the perception at the Fed, whose models continue to believe in the wealth effect on spending. But that's essentially where they've taken their cue. I'm not going to sit here and say that the Fed can stop a bear market in its tracks, and I don't think they'll be successful doing that. I think that what they're trying to do here is provide some semblance of confidence that that tail risks are not going to be tolerated. Well, can the Fed come in and buy equities? Well, they probably can, and they might, depending on how bad this gets. I mean, after all, high yield in the capital structure resides right next to the equity market. Whoever thought that they would actually move from their traditional role as liquidity backstop towards being the savior of insolvency. But I think what it comes down to, and this is why I'll cut him some slack, is that this was a man-made, to some extent. Look, there's no doubt that we went into this. People say that there was no imbalances in the economy. Well, we went into this with balance sheets completely dilapidated, especially in the corporate sector. But there are wide swaths, even in the household sector, of debt excesses that should have been controlled. We always talk about this after the fact, but I think that there's this collective guilt. I mean, look what's happening in Congress right now. For the first time, the Republicans and Democrats are fighting over, you know, how much more to add to any specific package like the PPP. You got the president on board, you got the Democrats, Republicans all fighting over how much bigger can we make this next fiscal assistance package. Now, I say assistance because this isn't like FDR, where we're going to have the New Deal to try and put idle people back to work. What's happened here is that people have been told to stay home and not go to work. So I think there's this palpable sense of guilt at the government level, and that includes the Fed, that we made this decision here to tell people, you can't work anymore. You got to stay home. And so I think that the risk is that they may be going way overboard here, whether it's on fiscal policy or certainly whether it's on Fed policy. But I think that there's this, as I said, this collective guilt that we actually told people. This is actually, it wasn't even the virus. You can't even say that the virus, the coronavirus, caused this recession. It was the government's reaction that caused the recession. They could have done a whole bunch of things, but we went into basically national lockdown mode, and anything that's considered non-essential, which is 70% of the economy, just basically shut down. So I guess it's with that mindset that as a public official, which Jay Powell is, you know, the Fed is a construct of the Congress. And so that's why they're going into a realm that they've never done before, specifically because of the nature of this pernicious economic and financial downturn that was really caused by government decisions to begin with.
Let's talk more about the extent of the government response, because something I've said before, and it sounds like we're in agreement on, is, you know, the coronavirus is a really big deal, but I think that the bigger risk is the government reaction to it. And, you know, when you start spending $2 trillion a week in fiscal stimulus, literally for a few weeks there, and an unlimited amount of monetary stimulus, it seems to me like maybe this is the long-awaited catalyst that finally forces a secular shift to a secular inflationary rather than deflationary backdrop. Am I on the right track there? And if so, is that something that plays out in the next 6 months or the next 6 years, or how does it work?
Well, let's first address what you said initially, which is about the gargantuan fiscal stimulus, which is it is actually truly unprecedented. But we're in a situation now where you got some of these Wall Street economic houses calling for 40% down in second quarter GDP at an annual rate. And without much of a recovery, which we're not going to get, we'll get some. We could be on the precipice here of GDP being down close to 10% for the entire year, which is almost what you had back in, you know, 1930, 31. And so when you're talking about so far the stimulus, which seems incredible, I mean, it's been well over $2 trillion just on the fiscal side, which is about 10% of GDP, basically covers the hole that the recession has created. So that's all the government is trying to do here is just fill a leaky boat. That's why it's not really traditional stimulus. It's just basically to keep households and businesses intact. They may have a lot more to do. And then you got to weigh in the fact that a lot of companies are going to be focused on two precious words called working capital, and households will be building on their savings rates. So a lot of this money coming into the system, to the private sector, a lot of that's not going to get spent in GDP. A good chunk is going to get saved. So it's not even clear that the stimulus or the assistance the government's providing is going to be enough to fill that economic hole. So we have to keep that in some perspective. In terms of the very near term, look, there's no doubt that this is initially, and I mean for the next 1 or 2 years, this is going to be a deflationary shock of intense proportions, and it will be a deflationary shock that will linger on for the next, I'd say, 1, 2, or 3 years. We're going to be left most likely with double-digit unemployment for an extended period of time. There will be tremendous excess capacity in the business sector, and so deflation, if you have a 1 to 3 year view, is what we're going to be left with. If you're going beyond 3 years, I completely agree with you. I think there's going to be a time we have to basically not extrapolate what's happening now, you know, beyond, say, 3, 4, 5 years into the future. I think that'd be a mistake. And I think you're quite right that what's going to happen here is that at some point, demand will stabilize. We're not going to normalize. Nothing's going back to normal, unless maybe we get a vaccine, and maybe that in the next few years, that's going to happen, or we'll have the herd immunity and we'll just all burn through it. But at some point, what's going to happen is that the supply side is going to overtake the demand side. Demand will stabilize, but the supply side is what is going to get crunched really hard here. We're talking about the implications that this is going to have on capital investment, the implications this is going to have on productivity and labor productivity. When you consider the future, we'll be wearing masks, there will still be some form of social distancing at work, taking people's temperatures, they go into the office or into the workplace. This is all detrimental to productivity. That alone is inflationary from a supply side standpoint. And then you layer on what everything is going to mean in the future from a globalization standpoint, that supply chains will become more localized. The concept of just-in-time inventories, which was a great cost killer, is going to have to be reevaluated. And I see a future now where some of these trends were already starting with these trade conflicts in the past 18 months, but we're going to see a world that's going to be completely different. The trend towards populism, nationalism, isolationism, and protectionism, and dare I say socialism, is going to most likely, if you actually read the history books, is going to be on an accelerating trend. That means that the world is going to be shrinking in a lot of respects from a supply side standpoint. That is going to be cost push inflationary. At a time when demand is no longer imploding, when I look at where the aggregate supply, aggregate demand curves are going to be looking like beyond, say, 3 years, you're 100% right. We will come out of this. I would say, actually, wouldn't call it inflation. I'm going to call it a return to stagflation. And I think if you have more than a three-year horizon, that has to be on your mind right now.
Let's talk a little bit more about how this plays out, because I agree with you. What we've got a setup for now with the coronavirus and the impact it has on the economy and everything, it's all very deflationary. But you know, the cat's out of the bag. We know that the central banks, not just the Fed, but around the world, are going to just go crazy conjuring more money out of thin air. And I predict if you look back at this podcast 5 years from now, people would laugh and say, listen to these guys. They're acting like single-digit trillions is a big deal and a policy announcement. You know, it'll probably be bigger than that by then. But the thing is, at some point, it has to be, I mean, if I guess it depends on your definitions. If you don't want to call it inflationary, let's say it has to debase the value of fiat currency. So is gold the big winner? I mean, how do we navigate this period if we know something different's coming, but it starts with deflation, but it doesn't stay deflation forever? What is the investment strategy that gets you through this storm?
Well, I think that you'd want to own the areas of the market that are classic inflation hedges. Again, you know, we're going past the next 1, 2, 3 years of deflationary pressure. You know, so I think gold would fit in very well. Precious metals in general, commodities, I would say, real estate, especially farmland, in my opinion, especially when you consider coming out of this situation, realizing the impact this has had on the food supply chain. So farmland, real estate, commodities, precious metals, tips. I think that, consumer staples will be a good place to be, probably healthcare. You can actually concoct a portfolio that will be a great hedge against that inflationary future. The one thing that will happen is that the last thing you'll want to be in is going to be cash, because that will erode in real terms. But yeah, I would tend to agree with you that gold would be, and notwithstanding the fact that gold has maybe not performed as well as us bulls on bullion would have liked to have seen, the reality, big picture, is that it's still up 11% year to date. So it's still been one of the better performing, obviously, asset classes so far in 2020. But I do think that gold, precious metals in general, will be good places to be in this environment.
And so it sounds like you're not concerned. Obviously, the next 2 or 3 years you think is going to be a big deflationary shock. In normal times, when they're not printing trillions of dollars a week, I would say that's a good time to get out of gold. I think we probably agree that it's a good time to stay in gold right now. Maybe we'll get a sell-off, but most likely the money printing will outweigh whatever downward deflationary pressure exists. Are we on the same page?
Well, look, I still think that gold is an effective hedge even in a deflationary environment, because when you're in a deflationary environment with private sector debts as high as they are, it creates a destabilizing cycle of defaults and delinquencies. Now, 100% true that the Fed has provided a backstop for these fallen angels post March 22nd, but I've got news for you. The Fed is not going to be bailing everybody out. We are going to be seeing delinquencies and defaults, and there will be recurring rounds of instability. So gold is not just an inflation hedge. That's what everybody thinks, and they're right. But gold is also a hedge against recurring rounds of instability. So I would still say that there's going to be different facets of gold, different characteristics that you still want to have a good chunk of it in your portfolio. Of course, a good chunk is very personal. It's all contingent on what your comfort level is historically. Some people would be happy with 20% gold. Some people happy with 5% gold. Always benchmarked against what's your comfort zone and how much of it have you owned historically. But, you know, we talked about a lot of other things ahead of going into the stagflation, which is the growing global instability we're going to be seeing coming out of this. So I always say that outside of inflation, you value gold at 1 divided by T, or T is trust, or perhaps the inverse of uncertainty. And the future is very uncertain. And what makes gold so alluring is not just because it is this shiny, malleable metal that goes back thousands of years. It's that it's about the only thing that whose production function is stable at about 1% per year. That's the one thing that you can take to the bank is the gold production function. Now, maybe we can't predict what the demand of India or China or what the Russian central bank is going to be doing. Maybe you've got these central banks like Russia being massively negatively impacted on its balance of payments because of what's happening with oil. So they sell gold to cover their debt service payments. To me, that's all just very temporary and is a buying opportunity. But gold at its heart has a stable production function. And in a world where the production of money, where the production of almost everything has so many question marks in front of it, that you want to own gold just for the stability aspect of it.
Let's talk about bond yields next. If we're expecting deflation for the next 2 or 3 years, the normal argument would be, okay, duration risk still makes lots of sense. Let's expect lower treasury yields. But as we get to the zero bound on the U.S. 10-year, you know, is that just another number on the way to negative yields, or is there really a zero lower limit there that we have to rethink the strategy on bond yields?
Well, nothing arithmetically says that the 10-year Treasury note yield can't go negative any more than you would say theoretically or practically that we couldn't have negative 10-year yields in Japan or in wide swaths of Europe. And so nothing stops, really. If we go into a deflationary experience, if we go into an experience where the term premium starts to price in a Fed policy that shifts to negative interest rates. Remember that the Fed no longer just talks about, they don't talk about the zero bound anymore. They talk about the lower band. You've had other central banks, by the way, talking more openly about negative interest rates. And I'm not saying that's what the Fed's going to do, but all that has to happen is that the bond market starts to price that in. In the context of a deflationary environment and a huge savings glut in the private sector, that you can't rule out the 10-year note going below zero. There's nothing magical about it. It all depends on the constituents of what makes up a nominal yield, the real rate, inflation expectations, and the term premium. So can you go negative? Yes, you can. Are there other opportunities there right now in the fixed income marketplace to focus on where you probably have to take on a little more risk, but to get some yield? I'd say that, and I say this in the context of that you still want to have treasuries in your portfolio, much like you want to have gold in your portfolio. At least you'll get some sort of positive yield right now. It's not much. But I would say the municipal bond market, we're not going to get through this situation. We are not going to get through a recession if state and local governments are not made whole. They are a huge chunk of GDP outside of the consumer, the biggest chunk. The Fed's already told you we're going to backstop this group. I'd hazard to say that the federal government would come to the aid of any state and local government that was on the precipice thereof of financial difficulty. So I'd say that the muni market looks relatively attractive to me. I'd say within the corporate credit market, you know, would I be buying high yield? No. Would I be buying triple C distressed credit? No. But there are parts of the investment grade universe, whether it's, I'd say, single A high credit, or I would say triple B high credit, that you can formulate a strategy in the corporate market, pick up some yield in areas where you have some confidence, where default risk is low, even in a recessionary environment. And so I'd say that there are some pockets outside of treasuries in the fixed income space that are worth looking at right now.
What does all of this mean for emerging markets? Obviously, some of them are going to get hit harder because they don't have the medical resources that developed nations have. What's the fallout after or during the rest of the coronavirus crisis going to mean for emerging market equities?
Well, you know, there's so many correlations here that you have to run, and understanding that the emerging market space is like talking about healthcare. Are you talking about hospital services, biotech, pharma? And the emerging market space is also very heterogeneous. So you certainly don't want to be long in any emerging market country right now that, for example, is a big oil exporter. Like, I don't think you'd be really fawning over, Indonesia right now. So I think that that's got a bulk large energy exposure. I think that countries that ended up not spending as much blowing their brains out on solving the coronavirus, you know, deserve a look. There are countries that actually got ahead of this very quickly that ultimately won't have to expend as much fiscal and future taxpayer resources to fund the largesse. So you could be looking at places like Taiwan or Korea or Singapore, notwithstanding the fact that Singapore has had another wave. The amount of money that a lot of these countries are spending to deal with the situation is far less as a share of GDP than it is in the United States. So I'd say that there are some parts of emerging Asia that are attractive, both their equity market and their fixed income market. I just named a few. Latin America is a little more dicey just because of the exposure either to oil or to commodities, which will be part of this near-term deflationary environment that we're in. So I can't say that I'm overly bullish on Latin America. Maybe there's parts of Asia that look interesting. The big wild card is going to be, you know, what happens to global supply chains that benefited not just China, but also a good chunk of emerging Asia. That's really the unknown as to the extent to which global supply chains that generated manufacturing capacity in a lot of these emerging markets end up coming back into the confines of the U.S. economy. That's, again, a really big unknown. So the emerging markets right now, I'd say more like the capital markets in general, you've got to be extremely selective.
A lot of people have speculated that once the crisis is over, there's going to be newfound hostility and tension between the U.S. and China. A lot of Americans feel like China withheld critical information that could have allowed other countries to get through the crisis much more easily. Now, regardless of whether or not that's actually true, the perception exists and it potentially leads to more tension between these two superpowers. What are the implications of that economically if there is a breakdown between U.S. and China from a trade relations standpoint?
Right. Well, look, I think that in the U.S., this distrust with China is one of the few things the Republicans and the Democrats can agree on, you know, outside of how much more money can we spend to put a floor under the economy. China is certainly something that they both agree on. And it's not just the U.S., it's really the world. The world is going to view China with an even more skeptical lens, and I'm being charitable when I say that, than it did previously. So it's going to make any future trade deals with China that much more difficult. And it's going to, I think, impart what I said earlier, generally speaking, which is a world economy that is going to grow further apart than grow closer together. When you consider that, you know, it's, you know, think of the world economy today, it's really, it's the U.S. and it's China. And so what I think happens here is that we have a relations that were already frayed, that will become more separated over time. And that'll have other geopolitical implications as well. It will force China maybe into other alliances, but their problem is going to be that other countries are going to view China much the same way that the U.S. does. So then the question becomes, after China joining WTO almost two decades ago, and there's a lot of people around that are in the financial business that have only known what the world is like in the bi-powerful world when you have China and you have the United States. And now we have a situation in the past 20 years where China grew more into the global economic sphere, and now it's going to end up potentially becoming less part of that global economic sphere. So you can almost view this as the start, and maybe it was starting with these trade frictions anyway. Maybe this just reinforces something that was just starting post-Trump presidency, which is an economic cold war, and not just between China and the United States, but now between China and the rest of the world. By the way, one other reason why gold will fit in well, or gold stocks, physical gold, because of the hedge against what will also be a potential of global political instability coming out of this in the future.
I want to shift gears now and give our listeners the inside story on the launch of Rosenberg Research. Most of our listeners know you, David, as the Breakfast with Dave guy. And certainly for anyone who's not familiar, Breakfast with Dave is probably the most well-respected daily newsletter that has existed in the industry for decades now. You've been through, I think, three or four different jobs. It seems like any firm that can get you on their team, if they can be the host of Breakfast with Dave, it's always worth it. worth it to them because your letter is just so highly respected. Seems like you kind of had a pretty cushy job, first with the position of being chief economist at Merrill and then moving on to Gluskin Sheff in the private wealth management area. You just went and took on a whole bunch of extra work launching Rosenberg Research. So you must have some big ambitions. What's going on? What led to this? What's driving you to kind of launch your own firm and go to the next level with your work?
Well, you know, the benefit of the previous 10 years at my former employer was that I was able to market my research to outside clients. And I had over 2,000 clients in 40 different countries around the world, split evenly pretty well between individual investors and institutions. And I just decided in the past year that maybe it was time just to hang up my own shingle, not have to be part of the pitching product in a either buy-side shop or sell-side shop, really just concentrate on unbiased research that will produce short ideas and long ideas and not just always having to have a bullish bias, which I found, actually, being on the buy side so long, I managed to see all the research coming from all my competitors on Wall Street and Bay Street. And I'm not going to say that that anybody is necessarily biased, but the reality is that when you work for an employer, when you work for another shop, especially a shop that is in the business of selling financial products, there is some pressure to toe the party line. And so I decided, not that I, and this is something I always resisted, by the way, but I just want to spend 100% of my time not pitching product, and I want to spend 100% of my time building a team, which I've done, and formulating research that's going to be helpful to clients in the financial services industry, investors, to connect the dots between the economy and the markets and come up with a coherent and cogent financial plan. And so that's what I want to spend all my time doing. And so that's why I endeavored on this, was so that I can call the shots, I can direct the traffic, but I also can spend 100% of my time 24/7 with me and my team producing the research that I think is most important.
Now, back in the day, the research in question was really the Breakfast with Dave newsletter, but it's grown to more than that now. So what are you offering through Rosenberg Research beyond the Breakfast with Dave newsletter?
Right. Well, the Breakfast with Dave newsletter was what people on the outside always saw. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of other work, you know, that I'd be doing, spending time with salespeople, with traders, with portfolio managers internally. And so the company I worked for over the years were invariably my primary client, and that makes perfect sense. And now my primary clients are my subscribers. So I can provide just a much larger set of products and services now. It's not just Breakfast with Dave. Breakfast with Dave was what always the outside world saw. They didn't see what I was doing day to day inside the walls of the company I was working for. It was a lot more than that. And what I do outside of Breakfast with Dave is one of the services that my clients can get. It involves conversations over the phone. It involves podcasts. It involves doing special reports. We've done probably 4 special reports already on the coronavirus and the implications near-term, medium-term, long-term on how to invest. So special projects, the Breakfast with Dave, when something in the middle of the day, it could be any time. It could be the Fed does something. It could be that the Treasury does something. I write about it and I send it off to my clients right away. I didn't do that before. I would do that internally, but I didn't do it externally. Now I do that externally. And of course, you know, I mentioned podcasts, but a lot of what I do, like I'm doing with you right now, is verbal interaction. And I didn't do a lot of that back in my previous incarnations, but I do that now. So if you go on the website, rosenbergresearch.com, you'll see all the different products and services that are being offered. But it transcends just Breakfast with Dave. Breakfast with Dave is still what I would call is the Big Mac. But there's a lot of other side dishes that I'm offering right now alongside that.
David, let's stay focused on the Big Mac or Breakfast with Dave just for one more minute, because with your previous employer, it was possible for people to get a 1-week trial of that. We were able to negotiate for Macro Voices listeners to get a full month free trial to Breakfast with Dave. How about extending that offer again and giving our Macro Voices listeners a chance to get a 1-month trial?
Absolutely. 1-month trial. And by the way, not just for Breakfast with Dave, you can have a 1-month trial for everything that I do in a given month. And so that I do an early morning with Dave, which is the first thoughts in my head when I get up in the morning. It's a few pages of just my random thoughts, and then Breakfast with Dave comes out shortly thereafter. But you'll also, if you come on, you'll get my podcast. You'll get maybe special reports, could be in a specific country. You mentioned emerging markets. We did a whole report on emerging markets a few weeks ago. See, this is the sort of stuff I was not doing previously. So you can actually come on, get a 1 month trial of the whole smorgasbord. And would love to get as many people signed up as possible, because the operative goal here from my lens is to have influence and be impactful and helpful for people that have to actually put money to work in the markets. I'm actually here to help guide you and limit the prospect of making a mistake, but also doing what I've done over the course of my 35-year career, which is always looking around the bend. It's all about mitigating your risk. So that's the mindset that I have, and I would love to have as many people as possible come on the website and for a full month, look at the whole product of services that are being offered.
Listeners, you can sign up for that free one-month trial, which I highly recommend, at rosenbergresearch.com. I also strongly recommend following David on Twitter. That's at econguyrosie, all one big word, econguyrosie, on Twitter. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Dave. You know, I always like his perspective on it. I've always had a slight bearish stance to everything, and I always find his way of looking at things just echoes mine. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, what I really enjoyed most was Dave's perspective on inflation, stagflation, where we're headed. And listeners heard this interview. They didn't hear my phone call with Harley Bassman this week. Harley echoed a lot of the same sentiments that Dave did. And basically, my conclusion is, look, probably the biggest thing that will happen in our entire careers in finance will be the secular shift from a deflationary backdrop to some flavor of inflation, whether that be outright inflation or stagflation or, you know, something new. I'm not sure. And it seems like all the smartest guys in the room agree, yeah, that's coming, but that shit doesn't happen overnight. That probably takes a few years to get through the current cycle and to get to all of that money printing. You know, it's a lag effect. It doesn't immediately cause inflation when you start printing money like crazy. It takes a while for that to actually flow into the economy and for the velocity of money to start to pick up. So the question in my mind now is, okay, what's the roadmap from here forward in this macro environment as we, over the next several years, I'm not sure when, make a transition from the current environment to some flavor of inflation, probably stagflation? And I'm going to keep asking all of the smartest guys that we interview on Macro Voices and try to assimilate a better worldview myself from our guests. But Patrick, I want to move on now to your chart book. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't registered yet at macrovoices.com. No problem. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button next to David Rosenberg's picture that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, page two here, we're looking at the S&P. Looks like your chart shows the same thing I'm thinking, which is bear market rally. Is it done yet? What do you think?
Well, first of all, this entire chart book is all going to be focused on oil crash 2020. That's epic. But I just love this analog because, to me, we put it on a month ago and we've been just more or less pasting the existing chart as it's going on top of what we drew as the analog of how 2008, 2009 happened in the post-Lehman part of the drop. And so we had a bear market bounce, and this 2800 level, more or less, is about a 50% retracement of the crash. And this continues to be the single single biggest question that we have to figure out is that, is this all this little bear market bounce is going to muster up? And if it is, how does the next phase of a downdraft look? And I continue to be in a position that believe that it's a bear market rally. I continue to think we're going down, but it may take a little bit longer than a lot of times. I wouldn't be surprised if we go another week or two of it just kind of dropping and popping and dropping and popping and fake out a number of times, and then everyone kind of loses their conviction to want to be short, and then no break. That's my intuition anyway. But let's move on though, because on page 3 I have the May contract, and I'm showing an hourly chart here from April 16th to the 21st showing that drop. And I can't think of a better person to take us through the play-by-play on what the hell happened here. So what happened?
Well, let's talk about both what happened and what didn't happen. First, what you're seeing here on page 3 is the May delivery contract for West Texas Intermediate crude oil on the day before the last trading day, dropping all the way down to -$40 just a few minutes before the close. If you caught my All-Stars interview with Louis Vincent Gaff, this was happening in real time as we were recording, and Louis and I kind of talked through the play-by-play as oil was crashing to negative numbers as it was happening. The important thing to realize here is this is not the real price of oil. By the time this happened, we were in the final hours, if you will, of that expiring May contract. All of the volume had moved over to the June contract at that point. So the prices that refineries are paying for oil in order to make gasoline that you buy at the gas station and put in your car, that never went negative. Those prices stayed up around $20 all day long. What happened was a squeeze because some really, really incompetent people did some really, really dumb things on the last few days of trading. Now, to understand this, we're going to need to really take a deep dive into how the futures market works, because there's a lot of emphasis on that last day of trading. Well, this contract expires on the 21st of April. Well, it's true that it expires on the 21st of April, but really the more important date to understand is not the 21st of April, but the 16th of April, which is the options expiration day. Now, it's known as OPEX day because it's when options expire, options, put and call options on crude oil contracts. But it's also the day that the exchange imposes a position limit on everybody except for the physical traders in the marketplace. So it's important to understand most of the market, I'd say at least 80% of the oil market, I don't know the exact figure, are paper longs and shorts. In other words, people who are speculating or hedging for whatever reason on the price of oil. Both the longs and the shorts are people who are buying or selling oil for the purpose of trading its price with other traders. They don't intend to physically accept delivery of that oil. Now, the futures market is used by the real live refineries and producers of oil to transact real live physical transactions. But those physical transactions are a very small part of the overall volume that exists most of the time. It's on OPEX day, 3 days before the last trading day of the contract, when the exchange imposes, and actually it was a full week before that, that the exchange recommends that paper longs and shorts roll their positions forward into the next contract. But they don't actually impose a position limit, which restricts all traders except for the guys that are actually active in the physical market, taking physical delivery of oil into a tank. Everybody except those guys is supposed to be under 3,000 contracts by 2:30 in the afternoon on the OPEX day, which would be April 16th in this case. Now, Patrick, to you and I, 3,000 contracts probably seems like a lot because every contract is 1,000 barrels of oil. So we're talking 3 million barrels of oil. That's a lot of money, although I guess if it goes negative, it's not a lot of money. In any case, for the big boys, the institutional guys, it's not a huge number. So everybody has to be out of their speculative trades by the end of OPEX day at 2:30. The only people that are supposed to stay in the market for any sizable position bigger than 3,000 contracts are the physical traders in the physical market. The phrase that they use hedgers is bona fide hedgers. They have to be designated by the exchange as a bona fide hedger in order to stay in the market with more than 3,000 contracts after OPEX day. Now, the way that any roll process works, you've got longs and you've got shorts. So the guys that are going to roll their position forward to the next contract, if you're the guy who's long, you're hoping that the contango, the price premium that you're losing by rolling to the next contract is as small as possible. If you're the guy who's short, you want it to be as large as possible because you're capturing that as a profit. So there's kind of a game of chicken going back and forth where the longs and the shorts are trying to figure out, okay, what's the ideal time for me to roll my position forward. If you've got a storage crisis, which is headline news all over the world, you would think that even retail traders and certainly any institutional trader has got to be smart enough to understand that the last thing you want to be is long a contract that you don't have a tank to accept delivery on because you could get squeezed out. So the way this works is you've got paper longs, the guys who are long the market because, you know, they're speculating on hoping the price of oil goes up. They wanted to buy the low price and the contract was at a low price. They have to roll their position forward to the next monthly contract. What happens is they think, and this is the anatomy of a squeeze, they think the other guys in the market are paper shorts who also have to roll forward. And all of a sudden it turns out that the only shorts that are left, which are the only guys that can close that contract out for them, are physical shorts, guys in the physical market who actually have the oil to deliver. So the paper guys are saying, wait a minute, the deadline's coming up. I have to close this contract. I've got to get somebody that will roll me forward into the next month. You know, you shouldn't charge me that big of a premium, guys. This is already at a record. The guys that have got the oil in the tank are like, hey, we can deliver. This game of chicken is stacked in our favor. We don't have to get out of our contract. We can stay in it and deliver the physical oil. We got more than we need. What happens is the guy who's in that long paper position, the price just gets forced down and down and down until he's forced to take a really lousy trade. What happened in this case is when the number went negative, the problem was exacerbated because some of these paper longs were retail investors and they were with Interactive Brokers, which normally has a fairly sophisticated computer system. IB's rules force everybody who is either long or short in a physical delivery contract to be out 2 days before the contract expires. That's their rule, but they don't actually force liquidate the contract until the morning of the day before the last day. So that would be Monday morning. I think what happened is the price went negative on Monday morning before IB did those forced liquidations. Their computer got confused about the negative price and they didn't force liquidate people there. They didn't realize how much they were losing. And those traders were unable to get out of their positions because the IB computer wasn't handling the negative prices correctly. And the shorts that had the ability to physically deliver saw their opportunity to just squeeze it. They said, you know, we want deeply negative prices in order to let these longs out of their positions. Now, here's the amazing part, Patrick. Bank of China, okay, that's institutional. You would think this is people get paid to do this job for a living. You'd think they'd know something about it. How could they possibly have more than 3,000 contracts long? Well, what is their product? Their product is basically sort of like the USO ETF, but it's in China. It's a fund that invests like a crude oil tracker fund. Well, wait a minute. It's sold to retail investors. That's not physical market. Well, Bank of China, once in some other transaction a few years ago, did something in the physical market. They've got a designation somehow with the exchange as a bona fide physical hedger. So they've got apparently quite a few thousand contracts long. Why? Because they've got this USO-like retail fund of oil contracts, and it didn't occur to them when front page news is that there's a storage crisis across the entire industry that staying long until way after the exchange requires all of the non-physical delivery people to get out of the market. was somehow a good idea. They waited until the very last day, and they waited until late in the day on the very last day. It was actually the day before the last day of trading. And they realized that they were stuck and they had to get out at negative prices. So what happened is there was a squeeze. The shorts realized that they were holding all the cards and they pushed the price deeply negative because a whole bunch of traders just couldn't get out of their positions any other way. What happened, though, was a few thousand contracts out of, you know, more than half a million contracts that are normally active in the front month contract. Just a few thousand contracts traded at these deeply negative prices, and some people got just taken out on a stretcher. It doesn't mean that the price of oil really went negative in terms of the economic signal that that would normally have or what it would mean to the economy for the price of oil to go negative. What it means is that a crazy situation happened in the May contract.
Okay, well then what happened next in the June contract the day after?
Well, that's where we get to, okay, this time it is an economic signal that's really important. The June contract on the following day, that's Tuesday of this week, traded all the way down to $6.50. Now, how the heck could crude oil, it's not the phenomenon we just talked about of the expiring contract having a squeeze. It's actually the open trading on an open exchange of the current active front month contract. And I think, what was it at the end of the day on Monday? It was still over $20. And by early afternoon on Tuesday, it was $6.50. How is it possible that that could happen? Well, talk about crazy stuff that only happens in the oil market. One of the things that happened on Tuesday is I think that USO, the really big US ET, it's actually an exchange traded note, ETN, not ETF, although I always call it an ETF, even though I shouldn't. The USO fund, I think they got spooked by what happened on Monday. So even though they had already moved some of their exposure out of the front month, they decided to move a whole bunch more of their long exposure because they don't want to be part of that squeeze if it happens again. They said, we're not waiting till the end of the month. We're getting the hell out. Furthermore, they were pretty sloppy about the way that they got out. So they moved the market massively by selling a huge number of June futures and buying July and August futures to replace them. So they rolled their long exposure forward from June to a combination of July and August. And they did it in a very sloppy way. They moved the needle, as the expression goes, considerably. And that's what got us all the way down to 650. Once USO was done with their big sloppy roll, the market started to recover. We managed to get back up today to the 5-day moving average at about 1750. But I still think that, you know, even though it was influenced by a crazy event with USO doing some, what I think was some reckless trading in the market, hey, it was happening at a time in the front month active contract when there was plenty of price discovery liquidity on both sides of the market. It wasn't a crazy squeeze situation. And we got down to $6.50. It says to me that there really is room to go back to zero prices. Now, I'll be very surprised if we get to another -$40 event, unless it's another one of these technical squeezes that just a few people got a few contracts stuck in a place they should have never gotten themselves into. But could we get to the real live price of crude oil, you know, goes down below $5 before June is out? I think the door is open to that now. We've had a little bit of a squeeze today in the gasoline market that I think was resolved this afternoon when Pemex, the Mexican national oil company, declared force majeure on gasoline deliveries. I don't fully understand the mechanics of that one because I had to get ready for today's podcast. And news just came out this afternoon. Looks like maybe that short squeeze is over, so I'm not sure if we're going a whole lot higher here. But we're back up to a number that, to me, makes sense. You know, 16.81 on the June contract as we're recording Thursday afternoon. Okay, that's a low price, but it's kind of in line with what we've been expecting and what we've been seeing in recent weeks. Are we going back down below $6.50? Well, you know, I do think it's possible, but it's not going to happen until until the end of the month when that contract expiry is approaching, and we get potentially an imbalance of paper longs to more physical shorts. And once again, the physical shorts are not very accommodating in terms of their pricing, and the paper longs start to get squeezed again. So I think we could see lower prices, even below that $6.50, in the real market, not in the special case, which really only affected a few thousand contracts.
All right, Eric, let's move on to some of these charts. So on page 5, what we have is that contango in the oil market, the super contango. Like, this is history, Eric. Like, I never thought we would ever see negative oil prices. And here, like, this chart is, well, I snagged this one from April 20th showing that minus 40 price and showing how the term structure has sloped. On page 6, we have now the new term structure with removing that May contract. So why don't you take us through what you're seeing on these charts?
Well, let's start with page 5. First of all, as you said, until this event, I'm pretty sure the all-time record for contango on the expiring contract was $8.79 set in December of 2008. And of course, that was during the great financial crisis, prices crumbling down to about $30, $32 on the front end. And there was a great big contango of and really, it only got to about $5 or $6 during active trading. And it was on that last trading day, when there's almost no liquidity left of the market, that it collapsed to $8.79. And that was, you know, the all-time record. And one of the things, and this is so frustrating for me, because I was short the May to June time spread going into this event. And the way I had looked at it, Patrick, was, okay, I know the world record here is $8.79, and I think I'm really going to be aggressive on this trade. I think we can hit it again. So I'm going to set my limit orders. First one at $8.79, and then I had $8.99, and I think $9.15 or something. I'm thinking we could go even past $8.79. And I was so proud of myself when those orders started filling on Sunday night. And I'm like, yes, I was right. A record. And what happened is I ended up closing on, I thought it was going to take until the end of Monday to get out of those positions. I ended up closing all of my short time spreads on Sunday evening at around $9 and change is the spread between the May and June contract. And as you're showing here, by the end of the day, the spread was like $50. Actually, it went to 60 at one point a few minutes before the close. It was just insane. Louis Vincent Gavin and I were on the phone at the time, and my spreadsheet, which calculates the value of my open positions in my account, is going to these insane, insane numbers. That would be if I had held the position and not closed it. And of course, I had already closed it. So unfortunately, I did pretty well on the trade, but nowhere close to what it would have been.
You weren't greedy, Eric. You weren't greedy.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean,
that business about hogs getting slaughtered, I should have taken the chance just this once on a few contracts, because hogs made out on this particular day, especially on the short side of this trade. But what we're seeing here is just a total record $50 difference between the May contract and the June contract. Only a few thousand contracts of open interest when this happened. And as I say, it was a squeeze. By the time the day was over and we got to the next day, you see on page 6 that contango had gone back down still to, I don't know, on the order of, you know, $5 or $6, but nothing close to where it had been. So that really big difference and the huge dislocation on May was an anomaly because of a trading event. But the fact that the June contract got down to $6.50 the next day is probably a bigger news event than the minus $40, although the news isn't covering it.
If I can ask, Eric, like, is a lot of people, the big question to them, especially those people that are investing into like these tanker stocks and other things, like, how long can this market stay in this contango? Like, I know, maybe not super contango, but stay in this thing. Like, how long is this glut going to be in there, that this, the shape of the curve stays in this? I mean, could this be for months? Could it be for the whole year? Like, how long can this stay this way?
Well, that's the $64 trillion question, Patrick. And not only is everybody trying to figure it out, but I believe that there are probably people who are trying to game the system to create false impressions. In other words, suppose that you're the oil producers, okay? And the whole world is concluding that there is super contango, there's no storage whatsoever, and it's pushing prices to zero. okay, you don't want the sentiment in the market to be pushing prices to zero. And what would really get them there is Cushing, Oklahoma, filling up with storage. Here's a, you know, one of those conspiracy theories that might just turn into conspiracy fact before it's over. An idea that's been circulating in the last few days is, hey, wait a minute. The value of keeping the price elevated to producers is much higher than the cost, as expensive as it is, of storage in Cushing. So if you were major oil producers, why wouldn't you lease storage space in Cushing, Oklahoma, and leave it empty on purpose, just to make sure that those EIA reports never show Cushing, Oklahoma filling up completely? Because you know that the filling up completely is the event that would cause the market to really crash toward zero prices. I personally am convinced, Patrick, that all of the space in Cushing is gone. It's all been leased, and I think that it's spoken for either by people who are intending to leave it empty or by who have their own plans for it. But the idea of there being spare capacity where, hey, if the market has too much oil and we need to buy some space, we just have to, you know, increase the price and surely somebody will be willing to sell us some storage space, I think it's all gone. I think it's already gone, and I think that could take June prices down, and it could widen the spread considerably. Now, when you look here at page six, it's kind of hard. If I look at the bottom spread, it's not as big as the next spread, but the next spread, the second one up to the third one up, which one is bigger? It's kind of hard to see that for sure. And also, with those all those little yellow dots, which one of those is July? Which one is August? It's kind of hard to keep track of them. So this is the conventional chart. It's called a term structure chart, which most people use. What I prefer is to look at the individual prices of those one-month spreads. So the difference between May and June, and the difference between June and July, and the difference between July and August, plotted as separate lines on a chart. I haven't seen really anybody else but me do it this way, but if you go to page seven, this is my chart that is showing everything curiously except for the May to June calendar spread, and I'll explain that in just a minute. First of all these letters here are just the exchange code, if you will. J is April, K is May, M is June, N is July, Q is August, U is September, V is October, X is November, and Z is December. Who thinks that makes sense? Probably somebody ex-military with the mustache. I don't know, but that's just the way the exchange does it. What you're seeing here is normally when these spreads expire, as they reach their expiration date, minus 30 cents, you know, the contango of just 0.30, that's a typical, you know, pretty good expiration for the storage guys. They can make a profit with 30 cents of contango on their storage tanks. What you see on the purple line, the one that says J-K0 on the left there, it really, on its OPEX day, only got, it was about 30 cents on OPEX day. By the end of OPEX day, it got down to about 40 cents. And then it was on the last trading day that it finally collapsed all the way down to 275, minus 275, which is $2.75 of contango. That, if you just look at what's left of that on the chart, that was totally unprecedented. We haven't seen $2 plus of contango on the chart in years and years. Well, look what's happened since. We see the subsequent months. Now, the white line, MN, that's June to July. The green line, that's July to August. The orange line, that's August to September. The light yellow, the pale yellow, is September to October, and so forth. Well, as you look at this chart, you can see that after the expiring April-May spread, that's the purple one, kind of set the precedent, all of the other spreads kind of let go of their traditional norms and started trading into deeper and deeper contango. This is a prediction, Patrick, of where the market is headed. The more months that you have out on the curve that are showing significant contango, let's say more than 50 cents of contango would be considered atypical. Any month that is showing more than 50 cents, that means the market thinks we're still going to have a storage problem by the time it expires. And just looking at this, you can't really see all of them, but I recognize the color codes there. It looks like to get to minus 49 cents, since. I see that on the March to April of 2021. So it's going all the way out till next spring that the market thinks there's going to be some degree of storage problem. Well, if what we can see here is first the April-May spread, and the next one we see is the white one, the June to July spread, why don't we see the one that everybody's talking about, which is May to June, the one that just expired? The answer is, when you display that one, it blows the scale of the chart up so much that it's crazy. So if you look at the Y scale on this chart, that's showing you the contango. A negative number means contango. A positive number, which is really not in play here, would be backwardation. So we see right now that the June-July spread is $5.41. That's kind of unprecedented because normally, even on the final day of trading, the all-time world record had been $8.79 until just last week. Well, that Y scale is going all the way to $7.20, almost to $8. So we're almost at all-time records as far as how big the scale is. Now go to page 8. As soon as I activate the display of the KM spread, that's the May to June spread, it goes down to minus $60 at one point on the 20th. So it just throws the rest of it is the same chart we were just looking at, but the scale has been compressed vertically so that you can't even see it anymore. So I had to show you two different versions of the same chart because it just didn't fit. But you can see that what happened is during that squeeze, this spread just went crazy. As I say, I was short that KM spread and I covered it minus $9. Very proud of myself for closing that position at a record-wide contango, only to miss the move down to $60 from there. If you listen to my interview with Louis Gav, you'll hear me just envying what could have been as I missed the end of that trade. Needless to say, where we're headed from here, let's go back now to page 7. You can see there's been a bounce today in this June-July spread. To me, it's just mean reversion. You can visually kind of draw a line between those peaks. I think this is played out, and I wouldn't be surprised if that rolls over again along with the front month price. And I won't be surprised if we get to even wider numbers. The chart you see on page 7 is only plotting end of day prices. So on June 21st, it's showing a number down there around $7.20 of contango. It actually traded at $11 of contango at one point during the height of USO rolling its position from June into July and August. I think that we're now seeing basically from that event a relief rally back up to its established downward trend line. And I think by the end of the month, we'll probably be back down into that record territory of 879 or higher. The other months we're going to keep watching, but it looks to me like more and more months are indicating that the market thinks this storage situation or this storage problem is going to last for several months to come. The other thing that I think a lot of people are not factoring into their analysis, Patrick, is they're thinking, okay, but they're going to restart the economy. They're going to get things going again. So surely, you know, all this oil is going to come back out of storage. What they're forgetting is there's 250 million barrels plus of floating storage. That's oil that's in tanker ships anchored somewhere off the coast of Houston. That's more expensive storage than the on-land storage. So before we start emptying out the on-land storage, we've got to unwind all those floating storage deals, the tanker trades. And you know, I don't think that's over yet. They're still adding more tankers. People are chartering more tankers and storing more oil in them. So this situation is not over till it's over. Saudi Arabia is still sending more tankers full of oil. That I just heard this afternoon, and I haven't verified this, so don't hold me to it if it turns out to be urban legend, folks. But I'm told that they're considering reversing the Seaway pipeline again. The Seaway pipeline back in the day used to go from Houston up to Cushing, Oklahoma. I think it was around 2011 or 12, they reversed it to go from Cushing, Oklahoma down to the Gulf Coast. I heard that they're actually talking about the possibility of reversing the Seaway pipeline again in order to take a full tanker load of oil in Houston and pump it up to Cushing. Why in the world would you be doing that right now when you've already got a storage crisis? Who's trying to accomplish what outcome in the market by doing that trade. Who decided that it was a good time to buy a full tanker cargo of crude oil from Saudi Arabia and add it to the already overwhelmed storage tanks in the United States? And what was their motive for doing so? I don't know the answer, but I think there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes here, Patrick. But Patrick, I have a question for you, which is, I know you're speaking at the Montreal Exchange Options Education Day. I think some of our listeners may be assuming that means if they want to go, they have to travel to Montreal. This is actually a virtual event, isn't it? What's the story? What do you need to do to participate? And where do you have to be in order to sign up?
The Montreal Exchange has always held the Options Education Days across Canada. And well, this COVID-19 situation has forced them to bring it online. And so they're opening it up as an online event. It's running on Monday, April 27th from 11:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. That's completely free to register. I'm going to be speaking in there with a whole wave of other great guests. And it's a great event. And you can find the links not only in the Research Roundup email, but it's also on the last page of this chart book. So anyone who wants to attend and just get a day of options education for free, make sure you join. Anyway, Eric, before we do wrap up, we missed one important thing, an update on the COVID-19 situation. And what's going on here? Like, there's so much news coming from so many sources. I don't even know what to make of all of it. Give us a summary here.
Well, let's start with the good news, because there is some good news. It seems pretty clear now that we're past peak infections, at least for the first wave in the United States. My prediction had been that just as in Europe, they had to go to triage, where they were actually turning people away and saying, sorry, you know, you need a ventilator, stay alive. There's no ventilators available. We're going to have to let you die. That didn't happen in the United States. I was afraid that it was inevitable. I couldn't be happier than to admit to being proven wrong on that prediction. So the good news is that we're doing a little better than I feared with how we contain. The bad news, though, is I think there's just a lot of people acting like, okay, so that means this thing's winding down, it's ending, we're going to just, you know, go back to work and forget about all this. I really want to refer our listeners, we have it linked again in our Research Roundup email this week, an article called The Hammer and the Dance. And the metaphor is basically the first thing you got to do to deal with this situation is the hammer. That's the lockdown, social distancing. Tell everybody to stay home for several weeks, as we've just done, in order to get the situation under control. The second half of that, the reason it's called the dance is because it's not easy from there. You don't just, okay, flip a light switch, turn everything back on, and it's back to normal. It's a balancing act or a dance that you have to go through to figure out, okay, how quickly can we safely restart the economy without bringing on too big of a second wave that potentially has, again, the threat of overwhelming the healthcare system. And it's a dance. I don't think most people, including the Trump administration, are really recognizing that dance is going to be difficult and challenging to navigate. We're not going to be able to start things up as quickly as economically we would like to without bringing on a crippling second wave. So I think that, first of all, it's not as easy as people are assuming. Second of all, a lot of the economic damage is already done. A lot of businesses have already failed. A lot of credit has already not been extended. China has a very real second wave. They've got, you know, medical issues again going on in Hubei province with an outbreak that is continuing. Singapore is having another wave of infections. And there's also been some concerning developments this week. One is there's more evidence now, mounting evidence, and there was already some before, that even for people who have recovered and who didn't really have very bad cases, you know, they had mild cases, they never had to go to the hospital, and they had this for a few weeks and they got over it and they're feeling better now. They may have had permanent lung damage, which, you know, makes this much more dangerous in terms of its long-term cost to society than was previously understood. The other thing that I've just done a little more reading on this week, Patrick, although it's not really new, there's a perception which is correct, which is a vaccine is probably at least a year off because the time it takes it. Now, there's a lot of people talking about, oh, such and such a company is very close to a vaccine. They're ready to test it. They're going to have it ready in 6 weeks. Well, what that means is they're ready to begin the clinical trial process, which usually takes a year, and not all of these vaccines make it through that process. A lot of times they figure out that it didn't work or that it has side effects or what have you. So as far as a vaccine being ready for mass consumption to immunize all of society, most people think it's unrealistic to expect that in less than a year. The thing that nobody's really focusing on is, hey, wait a minute, this is a bigger challenge than you think. There's the old expression, Patrick, they can send a man to the moon, but they can't cure the common cold. Well, why can't they cure the common cold? Because it's a coronavirus. Actually, the common cold is a collection of three or four different coronavirus strains. The problem is that the coronaviruses, unlike influenza, which you can develop a vaccine for, coronaviruses are RNA viruses, and the science is way above my pay grade, but the essence of it is they mutate very easily, they're harder to develop vaccines for, and there's never been a successful vaccine against any other coronavirus. Now, obviously, this is a really big deal. The very brightest medical minds in the world are all going to be focused on this. We're going to try really hard to come up with a vaccine, even if that is challenging. But it's a really big challenge. We should not assume that there's going to be a vaccine against this in a year. Meanwhile, there was news just came out today. Remdesivir, which is Gilead Pharmaceuticals' drug that was originally designed for Ebola, had some very promising initial trials. It looks like after some more clinical trials, maybe it's not going as well as people originally hoped. Financial Times reported that today. I haven't read the full article, so I can't really say. There's also this idea that's getting a lot more popularity, and it's almost hard to tell if it's good news or bad news, Patrick. And that's the idea that, hey, it's starting to look like maybe a whole lot more people have had this thing already than we ever thought before. And that means that the actual case fatality rate is probably a much lower percentage. In other words, this is a much more contagious virus than anybody imagined. It's already circulated through more of the population than we previously thought. And that means that even though there's lots of deaths, those deaths are a percentage of a much larger number, which means the percentage is a smaller number. And maybe that means that we're a little bit closer to herd immunity, where we wouldn't have to be worried about a pandemic outbreak because society develops herd immunity to the virus. Okay, first of all, one of the major studies was from Stanford University, got a huge amount of press. Chris Martinson did a terrific video that's on his Peak Prosperity YouTube channel, debunking it and just showing what utter junk science that study was. It seems like the authors were conflicted. What they did is they took a study process which would only be valid or meaningful as surveillance testing. In other words, against a random sampling of society. And they went to Facebook groups full of people who believe that they have COVID-19, and they advertised and said, we need volunteers. Obviously, there's a selection bias. You get a bunch of people who have symptoms and think that they're positive, that volunteer to be tested because it's the only way they could get a test was to volunteer for this clinical trial. So it doesn't appear to be a legitimate sampling of society as a whole. It has a very strong selection bias. Another study out of LA, Martinson hasn't done a video on that one yet. Mario Cuomo, the governor of New York, said today that antibody testing appears to indicate that as much as 21% of New York City residents who were tested in the test study may be antibody positive, which would suggest huge progress toward herd immunity. Now, having watched Martinson's video, not on whatever Cuomo is talking about, but on the Stanford study, I'm very skeptical. Okay, it's 21% of what group was antibody positive? Was there a selection bias where people who believed that they were COVID-19 positive volunteered to participate in this group, which is what went wrong at Stanford? So I think it requires a close inspection. I haven't looked at the details. It only came out just a few minutes before we started recording today's podcast. So I don't know, but I think that one bears close inspection. Bottom line, We need to get to the bottom of this. What we really need is broad-based surveillance antibody testing for all of society so we can figure out just how pervasive this thing is, how many people already have it, and how close to herd immunity we really are. We don't know that because we're not testing. We're not testing adequately enough. And we really, really need to put more priority on widespread application of antibody tests as soon as possible. They say they're doing it. They've just been slow to actually act. Bottom line, Patrick, this thing ain't over till it's over. I don't think we have our heads around the full scope of this crisis yet. And just because the first wave medically, hopefully, we're in the final innings here, that doesn't mean the overall World Series is over. It's just the first game in what could be a string of several games before the situation is finally done. In closing, I just can't say it enough times. Let's all support our healthcare workers. These are the true heroes of this crisis. Wherever you live, please thank the healthcare workers in your community for all of their terrific service. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the charts we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to an article from Seth Levine titled COVID-19 Catalyst for an Easy Game Against Passive Investing, and a great Paul Singer article titled Perspectives. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.